225492, 225493, 225494, 225495, 225499, 225513. Paul Abbott et al. Versus the United States of America. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Glassman for appellants.
Thank you. May it please the court, Ben Glassman on behalf of plaintiffs' appellants. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
This is the Gatlinburg fire case, and what the court needs to decide in this appeal is whether or not the plaintiffs complied with the requirement of 28 U.S. Code Section 2675A that before instituting an action, they provide the claim to the agency. The plaintiffs did provide the claim to the agency. In fact, they filed the standard Form 95, which is the notice of the claim. It was supplied to the agency. It's attached to the complaint, and it's in the brief. The complaint, the claim says that it identifies the injury, it identifies the date, it identifies the location, it identifies...
But it sounds like it's monitor and extinguish a fire. So how is that notice of warning? I mean, I don't think I don't get your argument that monitor is equal to warning.
Judge, we don't need to... The right inquiry for understanding whether a claim's been presented is not to parse the specific words that are in the notice, because what you have to give is notice of the claim, and a claim is a demand. So
as I understand it, the government, based on this, is going to look into whether they mismanaged the fire, not whether they gave proper notice. And it seems to me what's happened with the plaintiffs is the claims have transformed from you mismanaged the fire to you gave proper notice. Does that make sense? And so I'm trying to understand how the government's on notice by this, that the issue was the notice they gave.
Yeah. So just timeline, actually, the plaintiffs submitted, the government did started its complete investigation of this fire, which includes an investigation into its failures to warn of its firefighting activities. The plaintiffs submitted the claim, or the first plaintiffs, like Reed, submitted the claim, and then the government issued its complete report, and the plaintiffs filed the action. And the action, the initial filed action, includes all claims of negligence, including negligent failure to...
When you say filed the action, you mean in court?
Yes, that's right.
But I thought it just went 6 months and the government did nothing, and then you filed suit.
More or less correct. You can file suit after 6 months. In fact, they waited longer than that. But that's right. But what you do when you're filing there's a big difference between filing a claim and filing a complaint. A claim is just supposed to give the agency notice of what they need to investigate.
Right, but you didn't need, this doesn't give them notice, this is their beef, that this doesn't give them notice that they need to investigate their own notices. In other words, their own website posts and everything else about the notice they gave to the surrounding communities, including Gatlinburg.
This notice tells them that they were defit, that the injuries arise out of the fire and the National Park Service's failures in actions and inactions with respect to monitoring and extinguishing the fire. Included in that, if you were to investigate that, failures in the fire, is whether you gave warnings. How do I know that? Because actually it is in the report where the government undertook to investigate its own after-action response to the fire. So we know that they was included in their investigation. I do want to make a point.
Can we consider that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, you can consider that. I mean, the report is attached to the complaint number
one. Doesn't the government say, I can't remember, I thought in their brief they said that's akin to considering a subsequent remedial measure or something of the sort.
There's a footnote that says that you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't consider that because that would chill their desire to do after-action reports if it was leading to greater exposure to liability. I don't think that's right. Number one, that's a pure policy argument that's not attached to any legal authority. Number two, this is about notice, not about liability.
Okay, so let me accept that proposition. Can we, so in that report, is that tied specifically to this, or is it just their after action report where they investigate everything? In other words, are they doing it because this claim is filed, or are they doing it because we had a fire, we need to investigate what the heck went wrong?
The latter.
Okay.
Yeah. So
let me ask you this. Plaintiffs here seeking compensation for failure to warn, or are they seeking damages for not extinguishing the fire? And does that make a difference in these circumstances?
They are saying that the National Park Service officials failed in their actions and inactions with respect to firefighting. That's the gist of it. That's what they should have generally been investigating. This is not a form that is a complaint. It's just supposed to be something to give the agency some notice so that it can start an investigation and decide whether it wants to engage in any kind of resolution before you file suit. It's supposed to be making it easier for plaintiffs who have been harmed by the government or individuals to deal with the government. It's a minimal notice requirement, and I want to make a point that is referenced in the reply brief but is, I think, a little bit more important. When we're talking about what is a claim, that you have to give notice of a claim, it's not the same thing as a cause of action, okay? It's just a notice of a demand that you were injured in some way by some accident.
What's your best case for that, that it's broader than causes of action?
Actually, let me give you a regulation, Judge Thapar. 28 U.S. Code 28 CFR 14.2A. Referenced on page.
Can you say
one.
That again? I'm sorry.
40. Yeah, 28 CFR 14.2A. It's referenced on page one of our reply brief. This is the DOJ's regulation, and let me read it to you. For purposes of the provision of 28 U.S. Code 2675, a claim shall be deemed to have been presented when a federal agency receives from a claimant, his duly authorized agent or legal representative, an executed standard Form 95 or other written notification of an incident accompanied by a claim for money damages in a sum certain for injury to or loss of property. So when the government chides our argument on page 33 of their brief for being focused on the incident and just investigating the incident, that's exactly what the regulation says is what's supposed to be in a standard form 95 in a claim. In fact, you don't even have to use that claim form. And this court has said, in Judge Jones's opinion from Glarner, like, look, if you submit a standard form 95, you're going to satisfy these notice requirements if you just fill it out, which they did. It gives you instructions on what you're supposed to say, and they did. Now, I want to make a couple other points in terms of best cases. There's a case that's pretty darn on point. The Sellers case that this court has from the 80s, not the Sellers case, but it cites as the cases that it is using for its understanding of providing notice under 2675, it cites Shipek and Booty, who are two 1980s Ninth Circuit cases. Both of those cases, Shipek and Booty, involved claims where the claim that was submitted on the SF-95 was for wrongful death because a service member was exposed to radiation on base. In order to because they had to get around the Ferris Doctrine, ultimately the cause of action that was being litigated was the government negligently failed to warn the service member of dangers from the exposure to radiation after the service member had already been discharged from service. The Ninth Circuit says, in the two cases that this court said in interpreting 2675A's notice requirement, those failure to warn claims were included because you just have to give minimal notice. They could.
You're saying Sellers cites those cases.
That's right.
Sellers doesn't say that.
Okay. That's exactly right.
Before you finish, I want to ask you about the discretionary function exception, but I don't want to interrupt any exhausting questions that my colleagues may have. So just don't sit down without letting me ask about it.
That's okay. Thank you, Judge Thapar. I'll be happy to answer questions about discretionary function. I'll make one more point about the notice, and then maybe let me address the discretionary function. With respect to the notice, one of the things that I think that the district court perhaps got a little turned around on was this, there was a focus on this Third Circuit Roma case. That's the case where the volunteer firefighter was going to fight the fire. Somebody told him to take off his respiratory equipment. And he says in his SF-95 form, hey, they told me to take off my respiratory equipment. That's how I got hurt. And then in the action, the question was taking off the respiratory equipment and the cause of the fire in the first place. And district court says, well, that's indistinguishable. I'm not sure that Roma is right, but let's assume that it is. Analogize it to this case. The Third Circuit in Roma did not say, because he said that the problem was taking off the respiratory equipment, that he could only make an argument about take that as his theory of liability, said anything about firefighting, not about the cause of the fire. If you take that to this case, it would be, if Roma applied to this case, it would be if the issue on this case now was we were saying that the Park Service officials were negligent in letting the timber build up negligently over years so that there was a lot of flammable stuff and then they led to the cause of the fire. That's what Roma says. That is not the case here. The case here is right in line with what the Third Circuit says was encompassed.
Mr. Glassman, I just want to make sure my understanding is correct, that after the complaint was filed and the complaint included claims of failure to warn, the defendant told you that the claims were, the proof of claim, whatever was filed, were adequate. Is that the case?
That is exactly right, Judge White. That is exactly right. And there is, in fact, a letter that the government's lawyer wrote that says that. I mean, it says, obviously, the United States can't waste jurisdictional defects, but at this time, which, by the way, of course, it's not jurisdictional. We haven't talked about that, but I think that's pretty clear. But at this time, we don't see any deficiencies in the SF-95s that were filed. Now, if the government had said there was some deficiency, because...
But you're not... I mean, the government gives a response to that in their brief, and they say for those claims, there was no deficiency. But you weren't asking about the warning claim. I know you've addressed that, but I think that's a little unfair to say, because the government's point is, yeah, we looked at the claims, we said those are sufficiently filed, but we didn't know you were presenting this other claim. We're not saying all claims forever are sufficiently.
Well, that couldn't be right, Judge Thapar, because...
Why?
Because the Reed claim complaint had already been filed that included the negligent failure to warn as a count. That's what they were talking about.
In the letter itself?
Yeah. The Reed complaint was filed on May 23rd, 2018. The Atkinson letter to Ball was dated July 17, 2018.
And you saw their argument in their brief where they say that's all we were responding to was what this particular individual filed.
Yeah, but that this particular individual was Reed. Reed's complaint was pending. That's why the government was reaching out to talk to defense counsel. And that complaint did include it. So Judge White is exactly right. I mean, if the government would have said at that time that we're not sure that all of the counts in this complaint were included in your SF-95, could have been fixed, could have just voluntarily dismissed that complaint, amended the SF-95s. So absolutely, Judge White, and that's why the point that it's not jurisdictional actually has a lot of potential bite in this case if you think the notice is insufficient, but I think the notice is sufficient for everything we've been talking about. Before I sit down, I want to address the discretionary function unless the court has further questions. So with respect to the discretionary function exception, this is not some kind of slam dunk argument one way or another. I think the district court did a good job. There were two different motions to dismiss, one a facial attack and one a factual attack. And the district court said not discretionary because there is a mandatory policy in place according to the fire management plan, and didn't even reach the second prong of the discretionary function analysis. In other words, whether there was a social or economic policy involved in the...
Right, but, okay. But it seems to me these regs give, like 3.32C, have the potential to impact them. What is potential? Who is it going to impact? Those seem like discretionary calls.
So... It says that they will be notified of all planned and unplanned fire management activities that have the potential to impact them. Yeah, I agree. Right. I agree with that. If there was some argument that, if there was any factual argument that there was any kind of, or has ever been any determination that these were not, it had no potential to impact anybody, okay.
But weren't they making that call? I mean, isn't that a discretionary call? They're saying, okay, the fire's 3 acres. This isn't going to impact Gatlinburg. In fact, even the Gatlinburg fire chief, I thought this isn't going to impact them for 19 hours, and then it comes raging in. So they're making a determination, a discretionary call, about whether it has the potential. They're looking at, okay, what does potential mean? 25%, 50%? What does impact mean? These are discretionary calls.
Well, there's a...
The policy question separate, but...
There is a policy, the policy question separate. I think both questions, to be honest, I think both questions are pretty hard. I don't think this is, like, unlike a lot of the other cases that talk about, like, implementing discretion, this is one where you're at a pretty low level where policy choices have been made in the fire management plan, and then it's just a question of implementation.
So what's your best answer as to why this isn't discretionary? Because I get it's hard. I've struggled with it for a few weeks now.
Yeah. Not discretionary because, as the district court said, there was a requirement that it's hard to imagine a planned or unplanned fire management activity that doesn't have the potential to impact. And I would disagree that the
record you're saying shows, no matter, okay, so if you've got a campfire that gets a little out of control, so now let's call it, maybe it's a wildland fire, maybe it's not. I know that's a separate provision, but do they have to give notice to Gatlinburg? Because if the winds come, it has a potential to grow and impact them. At the moment there's a campfire, do they have to give, that gets out of control?
Not a campfire, but if there's a planned or unplanned fire management activity, yes.
So if there, no, the campfire gets out of control, so it's unplanned.
Yes.
They have to give notice. Okay, who do they give notice to? How do they give notice? Aren't all these discretionary calls?
Oh, I think that's a factual question. That's what the district court was struggling with in the factual attack on jurisdiction. But let me make another point, Judge, that I think is very relevant here, which is those are hard questions. The district court never got to the second prong of the test, so that's never been adjudicated.
The district court said these aren't hard questions, right? The district court basically said not discretionary.
Well, the district court struggled through two different motions to dismiss on this basis, and then this current motion came up years later.
Oh,
so this was actually this was the fourth motion to dismiss that we're talking about. So here's my point, though, Judge. The point is, this would be way, when you're dealing with hard questions, it would be way better for this court to address those questions on appeal from final judgment. There's no reason for this court.
Why? They're jurisdictional.
Because there's no reason for if the motion's denied, right? There's no reason for this court to address, in the normal course, there'd be no way or reason for this court to address those now. It's only here by the circumstance that there is a grant of a motion on this other incorrect.
But why have the parties go through all this litigation only for us to kick it on at jurisdictional grounds years later? That's extremely costly, especially for the plaintiffs.
The government is even saying that it's got additional evidence that it wants to submit in respect to this, so it could be considered on summary judgment. And in fact, there's plenty of cases that, Edwards, Wysick, Miller, all cited by the government in its brief, where the issue is considered on summary judgment. That's the better course. Let them present all the facts that they think are relevant. Let the district court decide it on the basis of the full factual record. Then let this court deal with stuff where it's actually brought up in the opening brief and fully briefed. And that's the best way to deal with hard questions, which, honestly, I think the discretionary function is a hard question.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jeff Sandberg for the United States. The district court's judgment here may be affirmed on any of the three grounds set forth in our brief. To start with the discretionary function exception, I think What makes this case a little bit easier than it might appear to be is that this court has made very clear that it's not enough that there's a mandatory duty in the fire management plan. We dispute that this bullet point in this guidance document was mandatory, but even if you take that as a given, if there's still an element of judgment or choice in how to implement that, then you move to step two of the discretionary function inquiry. It's not enough that there is a mandatory duty in place. And here, you know,
no one's ever decided right at step two. Right. Did the district court ever get to step two in any of its decisions?
The district court didn't get to step two. The discretionary function exception issues were briefed, you know, on both steps multiple times over in the district court, and now in this court, the plaintiff.
So what's wrong with Mr. Glassman's suggestion that if we find it's exhausted, just let that play out in the district court?
I don't think that makes sense. I think that there's an adequate record before this court on appeal. They filed an over-length reply brief that addresses both steps. This court may or may not be aware, but there are currently petitions for interlocutory appeal pending on the other half of the Gatlinburg fire litigation, in which all parties, the insurers and the government, are seeking this court's ruling on whether the discretionary function exception bars the failure to warn claims, which are identical to the claims asserted here in the complaint.
I guess has that case been argued? I'm sorry.
No, the petitions are still pending and haven't been granted yet. But we don't think, frankly, that there's it's a close call on step two, whether or not this is susceptible to policy analysis. I mean, you've got questions about it. There's been no dispute in this case that the government did ultimately provide notice, and in many different forms. So if this case goes to trial, it's the judge putting himself in the mind of the superintendent or the fire management officer saying, okay, when should I have done more than just issue a press release, which they did on the very first day that there was a fire. When do you raise public alarm? How are you going to get the word out? Are you going to rely on local officials? Are you going to go straight to the media? In the end, on Monday, they did both, but not right away. What specific information should be shared? Should you be encouraging people to take any particular precautions? Should they be evacuating? How do you allocate people between the public affairs people between coordinating the fire response with other government agencies versus talking to the media? Are there any countervailing considerations? If you raise the public alarm too soon, are you going to numb people if it fizzles out like the storm did today here? The next time a fire happens, is it going to encourage spectators to come into the park, as actually happened here? There were some, will that interfere with the fire operations? And, you know, some of the people, unfortunately, who died in this fire, they didn't die from the fire. They died in fleeing the fire. I mean, anytime you raise public alarm and send people into a panic, there, you know, are potential for car accidents. And so this is very much inflected with policy analysis. And so on step one, the question is, does this manual set forth a specific duty that requires the government to take some action below the level of policy? So we noted in our brief that there are actually technical measures for fire forecasting. The Gatlinburg Fire Department chief had his own. This manual could have said, look, if you see a 50% potential for this fire to spread at a rate of, you know, more than 10 acres an hour, you need to notify this incident commander in the state emergency operations center. But it didn't say that. It said you need to, when there's a potential for the fire management activities to impact, you need to notify. And there's another provision of 4.4.2 that says inform park neighbors of wildland fires. You know, in our view, even if that's mandatory, I mean, we issued press releases from the first day, and plaintiffs in their brief on page 41 actually say, look, we agree on the first day there was no duty to notify. Even though there was a fire,
you complied with it. That's different than whether it's right. That's a different question than the jurisdiction.
That's true, but what I think it reflects is that they can't say that the face of 3.3.2 has clearly been violated. If this case goes to trial, it's a judge putting himself in the mind of the superintendent.
I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying that my point is it's either jurisdictional or it's not. And whether you've complied with it is beside the point for whether it's jurisdictional. You agree with that, right?
Yes. The Supreme Court unanimously in the Galbert case did say that if there is a mandatory directive and the government complies with it, then it's still protected by the discretionary function exception. So that was the basis for our second motion in the district court. We said, look, even if you think that this is a specific and mandatory directive, which, by the way, it's not specific, we've complied with it here. And the district court accepted the government's submission about that in some respects, but in other respects said, well, I would like some depositions, please, from the Gatlinburg officials about what exactly happened in these conversations. And
but
we would submit
that it's easier for you to get it kicked on whether or not this is discretionary? In other words, the jurisdictional point versus the merits-based point? I mean, asking us to dive into the merits now is a lot harder than asking. I know we can.
Oh, no, there's no occasion to jump into the merits here. All you need to do is recognize that the fire manual here, just like in, you know, Montez, where there was a mandatory directive, just like in Rosebush, just like in Jude, just like in Sharp, just like in Reitz, just like in other cases from other circuits we've cited, there was mandatory language. The agency shall do something, some general standard, but it didn't specify a specific course of action. It left that to the judgment, and once you recognize that it's left to judgment, then it there's a presumption under Galbert that it's based on policy, but you don't even really need that presumption here because for all the reasons I outlined, there's obviously, you know, important public safety policy calls being made. Over on the presentment side of the case, if the court doesn't have any more questions about discretionary function exception, I think the point that plaintiffs are arguing to you is not one that we dispute, but it's not the reason they were bounced in district court. They say we don't need to articulate our causes of action in the claim form. All you have to do is provide written notice of the incident. That's exactly right. But the incident isn't just I was injured. The incident is, I mean, the claim form itself says, state in detail the known facts and circumstances attending the damage, injury, or death, and the cause thereof. So if this is a discrete car accident, as plaintiffs in their brief say it's not, you know, it's pretty, you don't need to say much more than I was in a car accident with the postal truck and I was hurt.
If they had said the government was negligent and thus I suffered damage, would that have been enough?
We haven't briefed that, and I don't think so. I mean, this our position, which we've advocated to the Supreme Court, is that you need to identify what the government's conduct was. And here they say, well, of course we weren't saying that the you know, failure to log the trees was negligent. Of course we're not challenging the meteorologist's negligent prediction that rain would come. Of course we're not challenging. But how are we to know? We should be able to take them at their word when they say failure to monitor or extinguish a fire, that they're not challenging land use decisions, that they're not challenging the communications functions of the park's public affairs office as opposed to the firefighters.
But as your friend says, they're just giving you notice. It's a notice thing. And it's, what's our claim? Our claim is we were harmed by your handling of the fire.
Right. And they said it was the handling of the failure to extinguish the fire. I mean, the respect in which the notice is minimal, and we completely
aren't
agree
we
it's minimal, is
terms in an SF-95, and doesn't the case law say we shouldn't parse it? And then, as Mr. Glassman points out in his reply brief, he cites 14.2A, which seems to say just give us notice and that's good enough.
Notice of the incident, which is both your injury and what caused it. And here they told us we're challenging the firefighting. Yes, it's true. We, for our own reasons, looked into everything that led up to the fire and what happened after the fire. And there were insurance companies that, after we issued this public after action report, they amended their claim form, the auto owner's insurance
company. State Farm's a lot more sophisticated than some, I mean, than Mr. Reed or someone like that.
It's true, but I don't know if I would concede that, but there's able counsel in all of these cases. But the plaintiffs had the ability to amend their claim form after the government's report came out. Some of the insurance companies did.
What about Mr. Glassman's point that the complaint was filed, then you said, yeah, it's fine, and the complaint included a negligent failure to warn?
Well, that characterization of what was said is incorrect. We've put a declaration in to the district court about what actually was said. What the government was trying to do was persuade them actually to keep most of their administrative claims pending before the agency, where, by the way, they could have been amended at any time to add more claims if they wanted to, and to litigate the Reed case as a test case. And so the way we were looking at it is there's nothing about Reed that's any different than all of these other administrative claims. And we said, yes, we didn't see any jurisdictional defects with the claim forms. And
you had the complaint at that point.
And we did have the complaint at that point. That's right.
So then.
But we didn't, there was no effort, like, in order for there to be any basis for waiver or estoppel under this court's precedent, it would have to be the government knowingly relinquishing a right, which we didn't do. We were preserving our defenses.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it for waiver or estoppel. All I'm saying is the government understood in that claim them to be presenting negligent failure to warn.
Well, the Justice Department attorney didn't focus on the failure to warn claim, but remember, this is about giving the agency notice to investigate. Did its public affairs people violate any regulations applicable to the public affairs function that would render the discretionary function exception inapplicable to them? I mean, by the time they file a complaint in court, this is no longer something that the agency can investigate. And it's not about giving notice to DOJ, it's about giving notice to the agency.
But the agency did investigate that.
It did, but it investigates for its own, it investigated lots of stuff, many things that the plaintiffs haven't sued on here, luckily, to make this case a little simpler. But the fact that the government itself has identified, things that in hindsight were policies that need to be improved, maybe we need more redundant lines of communication in case the power lines go down in a major storm. The government's awareness on the policy improvement side that there are things to do shouldn't be enough for someone to walk into court with a complaint. You should, at a minimum, present that claim to the agency first, which the insurance companies have done. They did it after the government issued its public after action report. We recognize that issuing the after action report does come at the cost of people can amend, they can file new administrative claims or they can amend their claims. But these plaintiffs didn't do so here, and they rushed into court quicker than we wanted them to because they were hoping to have all the cases before the judge who was assigned to the Reed case. So I think, there's strategic considerations on the plaintiff side that unfortunately made it so that they were unable to present the claim. But the important thing I want to leave with you on the claim point is just it's not about whether they've pled a cause of action. It's about whether they've just as a factual matter said what conduct they're challenging. And this court's cases about minimal notice are about saying, you don't have to attach evidentiary submissions. You don't have to attach bills. You don't have to attach invoices. You don't have to have detailed factual allegations. This isn't a state court medical malpractice affidavit of merit. This is just tell us what you think we did wrong so we can look into it. And they didn't.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if they said failed to follow mandatory regulations to monitor and extinguish a fire, and then at the end they also put, and they failed to give us adequate notice, that would be okay.
I think so, yeah. I mean, what they said is that the cause of the injury was that we allowed the fire to spread beyond the park boundary. It wasn't that we didn't have time to move our car or our belongings or whatever. So I think we just, the government has to be, it's a minimal requirement, but it is a requirement, and the agency has to be able to take them at their word rather than second guess them as
why
to what they're...
Why isn't this encompassed in monitor, as Mr. Glassman says, at some point? I thought he said that in his brief.
Yeah, there's a footnote that says, monitor in the dictionary. If you look it up as a noun, it reads differently than as a verb. I mean, their claim says that the failure to monitor and extinguish led the fire to leave the park. And what happened here was the fire started in a place where they couldn't directly fight it. And the government officials were not watching it overnight. And overnight from Sunday to Monday, the fire spread really rapidly. And, if it had been watched more closely, they could have changed their firefighting tack more quickly, right? So when they were just trying to hope for it to burn out in the small area it was in, as often happens in these wildland fires in this park, they would have changed, the theory the plaintiffs have, and they ultimately expounded in their complaint, but I think it's clear just from the administrative claim form itself that what they're getting at is that if we had monitored the fire more closely, we would have updated our firefighting strategy more quickly, and maybe there would have been a better chance of stopping the mountain wave from spotting the fires so quickly. So, obviously what happened here is a terrible tragedy, and the government regrets all of the harm that befell everyone, and we want to do better, but have better policies in the future, but we don't think it's appropriate for, a judge to be putting himself, Monday morning quarterbacking all the decisions that went into this. This was a completely unprecedented event. The Gatlinburg fire chief, who, has seen a lot of fires over the years, thought that it was not as urgent a situation as it ultimately proved to be, and then we believe the discretionary function exception is the most straightforward way of disposing this. It would avoid getting into the issue of whether presentment is jurisdictional, and we actually think the court need not opine on that because we don't think the plaintiffs have identified a sufficient legal reason why it matters, because we don't think...
Need not opine on what? I'm sorry.
On whether the administrative claim presentment requirement is jurisdictional.
You obviously think it is.
We do. I mean...
I know the great weight of the circuits goes against us.
That's right. We think that for the same reasons that this court has always said without question that the discretionary function exception in 2680 and the other exceptions in 2680 are jurisdictional, that the administrative claim presentment requirement in 2675A is jurisdictional. We also think the sum certain is jurisdictional. This court has said otherwise in the Köppen case.
And then in Kellum, which I wrote, I followed Köppen and applied it to A.
Right. So some of our...
It's unpublished, as you point out.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, some of our reasons for why we think that the claim exhaustion requirement is jurisdictional would apply to some certain as well, and so our intention with Copen, but some of them don't. I mean, the some certain requirement has an exception to itself where there's newly discovered evidence, and whereas the claim presentment requirement is just mandatory, and the Supreme Court and other circuits have held that that in other contexts that similar claim presentment requirements are jurisdictional even after
Arbaugh,
Henderson, and et cetera. So, you know, and given that the 2680 exceptions are jurisdictional, it's not as though there aren't things in Chapter 171 of this title that aren't jurisdictional, and I'm not sure the government...
Is everything in 171 jurisdictional?
I don't think every last provision in there would be, because some of them don't speak to, like, the requirements for... Some of them sort of speak to administrative things that happen within the executive branch. I mean, we haven't briefed that, so I suppose, you know, don't hold me
to wrap up your realized middle and full.
Sorry.
Questions, I'm sorry.
But we think that the 2675A and B are jurisdictional. But we don't think that there's occasion to get into it here. I mean, the government didn't seek further review in Copen because we ultimately didn't think it mattered in the context of that case. We think the better thing to do is to wait until a case where it really matters to opine on that. But if there are no further questions, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
To answer your question, Judge Thapar, about whether the claim form would have been sufficient if it just said, there was a fire, I got hurt, and there was negligence, or even just there were mistakes, yes, that would cover it. In fact, one of the many cases that the government cites in their string cite of cases about the malpractice cases is that Ninth Circuit Goodman cases that the government cites. That's one where the question was whether a claim about malpractice included one about informed consent. The claim at issue just said, my wife died from treatment and mistakes were made. And the court said, well, that's enough for the government to have looked into all aspects of this. Now,
can I ask you then, if I'm the government, my point is, yeah, if you do it broadly, I get it. I have to look into everything. If you do it narrowly, I look into what you asked me to look into. And you didn't ask me to look into the warnings. You only asked me to look into the monitoring and the actual dealing with the fire. And so you can be both too specific. In some sense, you can get punished for being too specific, and this is an instance.
My friend made a great point in his argument in response to that, which was, he said, really, you know, I guess the idea is that they should have been monitoring the fire more closely, because if they would have been monitoring the fire more closely, they would have given a warning that it was getting out of control and people needed to get out of the way, just like a freight train barreling towards you. So it's certainly within that context, Judge Thapar. And Judge White, it goes right to Judge White's point that they did do this investigation. This was done. They investigated everything that they needed to assess any claim by these plaintiffs arising out of their injuries. And so what would be the conceivable point to the point of 2675A is just to give them notice to do the investigation so they can assess. There's no point if they've done the investigation and they know all of the facts to punish a plaintiff for using the wrong specific words. That would turn 2675's point on its head.
So can I ask you about the DFE one quick question? Your friend said there's an interlocutory appeal. I wasn't aware of that. Why shouldn't we just grant that, consolidate it with this case, and decide the DFE?
I think that the opening brief on that has not yet been filed, Your Honor, and I mean, I don't know whether it's even been granted. It seems to me that it would be, and this goes to my first point about this court has no obligation to undertake a decision here about the discretionary function on this record in this posture, could just as easily be decided later. To your point about the timing, rule on the exhaustion, possibly rule on the jurisdictional one, which I'll mention something about that, and send it back. If this case goes on and there's a ruling by this court in ordinary course, the district court can account for that at the summary judgment phase. That's the easiest way to do it. And again, haven't even reached the second prong, which is a hard prong. Like if you look at the Kim case that they cited, the O'Scanlan opinion out of the Ninth Circuit Park case, They cited it for misrepresentation on the discretionary function. It actually says, like, look, you got it. You can't, don't want to confuse policy choices with technical choices.
But so your friend had some good points about why it's policy. I mean, he made a lot of good points in that.
I'm saying take a look at those cases that he cites fairly closely. Like that, the Kim case cited for another proposition is pretty clear that discretionary function would not apply to a scientific or technical choice as opposed to whether are they actually exercising a matter of public policy. It's a different thing. District court hasn't even opined on it. There is no reason for this court to rush into that. The far better course is to let the district court handle that on summary judgment, informed by anything that this court may decide in any other appeal that it decides to take.
All right, I guess you're out of time there, Mr. Glassman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your arguments, and the case is submitted.